This is The State of Things. I'm Anita Rao. When we think of the civil rights movement, very particular images may come to mind. Protesters being threatened by attack dogs or police wielding high-pressure water hoses. Photographer Jessica Ingram was struck by how these familiar media images are the same images that are memorialized in sculpture in Birmingham's Kelly Ingram Park, which was once the center, epicenter of the civil rights movement. They're clearly part of the dominant narrative, so she began to wonder what's being left out and went on a search to find out. Her research led her to roads less traveled in the Deep South, where there are few sculptures, road markers, or memorials identifying the racial violence that occurred there. Her fieldwork evolved from photographing these forgotten murder sites to collecting oral histories from surviving family members and researching cold cases. The end result is a book that serves as a memorial to the ordinary landscapes where extraordinary, often overlooked violence took place. Jessica Ingram joins me in the studio now to tell me more about her journey. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Anita. Happy to be here.
So this all began, as we said, or it began to simmer in your mind when you were in Court Square in Montgomery, Alabama. So take me back to that moment and tell me about what happened.
Sure. I was there in the summer of 2002, wandering around. I'd gone there with my cousin, Andrew, from a small town in rural Alabama where my family lived. And as I was wandering, I ended up at the Court Square slave market, and there was a historical marker there. And I'll just read the marker just to give the audience a sense of what was written. The city's slave market was at the Artesian Basin, Court Square. Slaves of all ages were auctioned, along with land and livestock, standing in line to be inspected. Public posters advertised sales and included gender, approximate age, first names, in parentheses it says slaves did not have last names, skill, price, complexion, and owner's names. In the 1850s, able-field hands brought 1,500, skilled artisans 3,000. In 1859, the city had 7 auctioneers and 4 slave depots, one at Market Street and Lawrence, another at the corner of Perry Monroe, and 2 on Market between Lawrence and McDonough. And as I was standing in front of that marker, which normally I approach markers and think, oh, I'm going to learn something, but I don't often feel a lot. And I had a just really emotional reaction to that. And just the realization that had that marker not been there, I would have no idea what happened there. That history would not be brought back into this collective telling. And it made me really then wonder what it means for histories to be erased, what it means for them to reemerge through historical markers. And then, as you said, what have I missed because there's nothing marked there?
So this book is a collection of these beautiful portraits where if you just saw the photo with no context, you would really not, and oftentimes not really understand what's going on. It looks like a vacant landscape and an empty field. So what helped you or what made you transition from looking at where the markers and memorials exist to where they don't?
Yes. Well, I was, you know, as you mentioned, Kelly Ingram Park, seeing the the dogs lunging in the sculptural way into the sidewalk, the water hoses, that's such a mediated kind of retelling. When we think about the civil rights era, images pop up into our mind. And I didn't want to be repeating that. I wanted to look at what's not been told, what's not been marked, what's been left out, which is what took me to these sites.
So take me into some of these sites. And maybe let's start with a photograph in the book of a homemade memorial to Vernon Damer Sr. So tell me about that backyard memorial and a little bit about who he was.
Yeah, Vernon Damer was murdered in 1966 in Kelly Settlement outside of Hattiesburg, Mississippi. He was the president of the NAACP chapter in Hattiesburg, and he was a leader in the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. He led a fierce local fight for voting rights, and he was often quoted as saying, "If you don't vote, you don't count." The day before he was attacked, he offered to pay the black voters' poll taxes over the radio, which was a threat. And the next day, his home and store were bombed. He got his family out, and he died days later from his injuries. His wife, Ellie Damer, has erected a memorial on the foundation of the shop. There's wildflowers in abundance there. There's a beautiful marker of bottles, these glass bottles that were left from the store. There is a historical marker on the street, but in terms of the site, it's this lovely handmade kind of architecture in his memory.
And I know you encountered some resistance from the family when you were attempting to kind of tell the story and look into this.
Yes.
Tell me about that.
Mr. Damer, Vernon Damer Jr., when I first called, was like, you know, my story's not for sale. You know, I need to know what you're doing. I'm not here just for whoever wants to talk to me. He obviously gets a lot of requests to share this story. And so I mean, this was indicative and true of the whole project, that it often took years. Like, I would call someone and it would be like, well, no. I'd call them again 2 years later and they'd be like, oh, you're still doing this? And then a few years later, they're like, oh, okay, yeah, we'll talk to you. Mm. With Vernon Dahmer, one thing that was especially helpful was investigative journalist Jerry Mitchell, who was formerly of the Clarion Ledger, and gave me a recommendation. And so Mr. Dahmer agreed to meet with me. And he brought me into his living room and he sat me down with him and his wife. And he made me make a presentation of what it was that I was doing. And I remember feeling so, like, more nervous than I am right now being on the radio. It's very, I had to really prove myself to someone who had a lot at stake and who was deeply impacted by the trauma of the story. And at the end of it, he's like, okay, let's go. And we spent the day touring the property of Kelly Settlement, sharing each other's files with one another, and me just learning more about his life and the life of his father and family.
I mean, I think a question that always comes up when you're doing kind of documentary work is, you know, what right do I as an outsider have to tell the story? How do I do it justice? You know, is someone, how do I kind of make them know that I will carry it in the way that they want me to carry it? So how did you navigate that as an outsider and as a white woman?
Mm-hmm. It's a huge responsibility, especially when, you know, this book has a lot of oral histories in it. And so asking people to recount trauma is a really big thing to ask. And it has to be done really carefully. And I think that setting has to be really protective. And there has to be a lot of trust. And so a lot of it was just perseverance, like continuing to work on this for years so that they could see I wasn't just dropping in and out. My network expanding of other people who are doing similar work. And then, you know, honestly, often I just approach with my questions. I really didn't totally know where this was going, but these are the questions I have. This is my intention with the work. And, you know, for the most part, that bore fruit. People were willing to share. And for a lot of people, you know, one thing that you find, especially the family members, repeated over and over and over, is this knowledge has to be shared. This has to be, like, the newer generations, the younger generations have to be educated so that this does not happen again, so that we do not encounter another kind of civil war in our country around race and racism.
So there have been some attempts on the federal level to look at cold cases, to look at these incidents of racist violence where no one was ever kind prosecuted and brought to, you know, have to face the consequence of their actions. So tell me about that and kind of how your work fits into the picture of that.
Yeah, I mean, I started working on this before the 2008 Emmett Till Cold Case Act passed, which opened up a lot more information from the DOJ and FBI files. So once that opened, the FBI created a list of cases they were going to look back into and started reopening them. There was not a lot that came out of that effort. It did reopen some old wounds. There were new questions. It brought it back up for a lot of people. And in some cases, like in the case of Frank Morris, who's in Verde, Louisiana, that was really fruitful because the newspaper there heard about it for the first time. And now his story is so much more understood and known. And what I think you find, though, is that journalists and the DOJ and investigators are hesitant to pick up cases where witnesses have passed, murderers have passed, there's double jeopardy restrictions. So often those cases don't get pursued, and they do have a harder time than entering this national narrative around the civil rights era.
So it really relies on journalists and people who are willing to kind of do that digging work. And you mentioned Jerry Mitchell. You worked with another journalist as well, Stanley Nelson, who really believes kind of he has a moral imperative to do this digging work. Tell me about that.
Yeah, he's so inspiring because he found out about Frank Morris. There wasn't a lot of hope that the case was going to be solved, especially with the resources that the FBI was giving it.
Remind us what the Frank Morris case is.
So Frank Morris owned a shoe shop in Faraday, Louisiana, and his shop was burned to the ground with him in it by Klansmen. And Stanley Nelson, when he found out about it, just couldn't believe that this had happened and that nothing had been done about it. He felt deeply responsible. And he says, quote, "I felt that it was important to put a real face on Frank Morris because he was admirable. He was the kind of guy you're supposed to embrace in your communities and protect. We had not lifted a finger for Frank. So I wanted people to understand who he was." And he goes on to say, "I felt that if the newspaper and at this newspaper, me, if we didn't try to find out what happened, who would? Nobody else was in a position to do it. it would have been immoral to walk away from it. And he's talking about himself and that him being the editor of the Concordia Sentinel, which is a small paper in Faraday, Louisiana. And he has spent so much time and resources just opening up the story of Frank. And through that, people are coming forward. People are having dialogue again.
But not everyone wants to retell their story or have the past dug up in this way. There's a really powerful quote from a woman in your book who kind of says, if you're not going to solve this case when you reopen it, then don't even don't do it at all. Talk about that re-traumatization and how you saw that play out.
Yeah, that was Anna Ruth Montgomery. She's the daughter of Maddie Green, who was killed in a firebomb when her house was firebombed in Ringgold, Georgia. And for her, yes, it was, please don't open this up. Please don't even put me back in the spotlight here. Don't expose me if you're not going to solve it. They opened it, and then 2 years later, they closed it with no new action. If I do believe that, you know, there's an oral history with Denise Jackson Ford, who's Worlis Jackson's daughter. Worlis Jackson was also murdered by a car bomb in Natchez, Mississippi. And she talks a lot about that exposure and how traumatic that was. But then she later goes on to say that at a time when she really wanted a marker put up for her father, the newspaper helped her write the story. So it was her voice. It was her telling that. And community members poured forward with funds to get that marker erected. And so she had a lot of ownership there, and the community responded to her. And that to her was the closure that she got in the absence of justice, was that acknowledgement years later by community members. We see you. We hear you. We will get this done.
So what kind of responsibility do you or did you feel to do this kind of work, and especially kind of when it comes to interrogating your own whiteness?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, I get asked a lot, like, if I, as a white artist, am allowed to do this work. And my answer is, you know, almost always, I do not believe that those who have been systematically oppressed are then solely responsible for acknowledging that oppression. This racist violence was carried out by white individuals, by white Klansmen, by the state. You know, in Mississippi, there was a state-run segregationist spy agency just created to thwart civil rights. That is 100% my responsibility to acknowledge. I don't believe that that we should be asking those, yes, who've been oppressed to then, like, do all the labor of acknowledging that. I think it's my responsibility as well.
And what's interesting about what you do in this book is you juxtapose kind of articles and original sources from newspapers at the time of what they say happened and your documentation of what happened and how much the focus at that time was really on looking at what happened to the white people.
Right. The focus in so many of the newspaper articles and the headlines was about the white racist perpetrator. It was about, you know, whether they were acquitted. It was about what evidence is there. It was never about the person who was committed to resisting oppression and then often paid the ultimate price for that. And so in the book, you'll see I often invert kind of this idea of the headline, where the textual narratives that I've included that tell the story of those who were committed to resistance are headlining their names at the forefront, and not headlining, the white perpetrator.
So you look at a lot of sites where there are not visible markers or not a lot of kind of obvious signs of what happened there. But you did go to Pulaski, Tennessee, not too far from where you grew up. And there's a really interesting photo at the beginning of your book of the building that's the original site where the KKK was founded. Can you describe that photo for us?
Sure. So if you go, it's on a road just off downtown from Pulaski. There's a red building and red window casings with green shutters and a red door. To the left of the red door is a plaque, and it has been turned around and rebolted in backwards. And the text on that plaque talks about the founding of the Klan. It reads that the Klan was founded on Christmas Eve of 1865. And then names the original six organizers. But this plaque has been refused in a way. It can't be taken down. It's a historical marker, but it can be turned around and in that way rejected.
I mean, that really brings to mind what's going on here right around the corner with Silent Sam and this ongoing question of what do we do now with the statue? How do we mark and contextualize the history of what was once there? And for someone who I went to UNC Chapel Hill and now going on the campus and seeing this kind of empty site where if you didn't know the history, you wouldn't know that Silent Sam had been there. What has it been for you to kind of see that play out? And what are your thoughts on Silent Sam?
Well, Silent Sam's a Confederate monument. And that was put up in the early 1900s, right? So during Jim Crow. I mean, my thoughts are that Confederate monuments need to come down. They cause pain. They're racist monuments. They were put up at a time to, they were as racist gestures. I mean, Confederate battlefield markers are a completely different thing for me, but Confederate monuments put up during Jim Crow, I think they were meant to cause pain. I think they should come down. I, though, would not interject myself talking about being an outsider. One thing I became so aware of was how intense the process of dealing with markers and monuments are for communities. They take a long time, and they should. There needs to be a lot of conversation. There needs to be leadership in communities around what needs to be done and how this violence needs to be named. Yeah, I mean, if you look, for example, at, you know, the Triracial Coalition in Philadelphia, Mississippi, it took years for them to get a marker up honoring James Cheney, Goodman, and Schwerner from the Civil Rights Summer Murders. That was an incredible process for them. They needed to have that. That process was healing for that community. They didn't need someone from outside coming and putting a marker up. They needed to go through that. And so, I mean, for anything, I mean, you see this a lot with around the country with markers. That community process is what is at stake.
I only have about 30 seconds left, but I know that you've spent time taking this book back to people who you documented, and their reaction has been kind of that healing of now this is commemorated, there is a marker. Tell me about any moments that stand out, just briefly.
Well, Charles Henry, for example, Isaiah Henry's son, was so moved by this. He has not had very much attention because his father did not die immediately, so he's not included in many of these narratives. And for him, he just felt like this book brought closure for his story to finally be incorporated in this larger narrative around resistance and racist violence in the American South.
Wonderful. I've been speaking with Jessica Ingram, whose book is Road Through Midnight. It includes multiple beautiful photos, and she is here to give a talk at the Center for Documentary Studies at Duke this evening. You can find more details and information at our website, stateofthings.org, as well as links to everything about her book. Thank you so much, Jessica.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.